From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Baritone Sanford Silvan doesn't perform often in operas, but when he does, it's usually one that's groundbreaking or controversial. He's performed in operas composed by John Adams and operas directed by Peter Sellers. He stars in a new Adams-Sellers collaboration called The Death of Klinghoffer. We meet Sanford Silvan on this edition of Fresh Air. Also today, we remember the great actress Colleen Dewhurst, who died last night at the age of 65. From our archives, we'll hear a 1987 interview with her. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the world premiere of the latest work from electronic composer Todd Machover. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Barton Fink. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A wave of anti-communist sentiment swept over Russia today as party offices were closed and party newspapers ordered shut down. People surged through the streets of Moscow demanding the removal of Soviet communist flags and other symbols of the party. City leaders in Moscow took control of the Soviet Communist Party headquarters, seizing documents they said might link party officials with the Kremlin coup. Russian President Boris Yeltsin ordered the suspension of Pravda and five other party newspapers and the seizure of their offices. He also suspended all Communist Party activities in the Russian Republic. Lithuanians, Latvians, and Estonians rallied today to press for their independence. Nationalists lit bonfires along a highway that extends through all three countries. Amid the turmoil that followed the failure of the coup in Moscow, the KGB and the Communist Party are on the run in the Baltics. John Budris reports from Vilnius.
In Lithuania and Latvia, the Communist Party has been outlawed and its property nationalized. KGB headquarters in Vilnius is closed down, with most of the documents either burned or removed by Soviet intelligence agents. Automatic weapons and ammunition were hastily left behind. Tacit agreements with the Soviet military have been reached, according to presidential aides. Even a statue of Lenin, which was regularly guarded by Soviet troops, came down earlier today, followed by a rally of more than 100,000 at the parliament. Meanwhile, Iceland has announced that it will exchange ambassadors with all three governments next week, making it the first nation to do so. For National Public Radio, I'm John Budris in Vilnius, Lithuania.
With the coup in Moscow crushed, diplomats in the Middle East say efforts to free the remaining Western hostages in Lebanon and other prisoners in the region can now continue. A Lebanese Muslim leader has called on groups in the country to supply information about seven Israelis missing there. Gerald Butt reports from Nicosia.
The release earlier this month of Briton John McCarthy and then American Edward Tracy led to hopes that the whole kidnap saga might soon be over, but problems emerged. The Israelis said they wouldn't cooperate in the deal by releasing Arab prisoners they're holding until they had firm evidence on the fate of seven of their servicemen missing in Lebanon. Then came the turmoil in Moscow, but now that things have simmered down in the Soviet capital, diplomats in Beirut hope there can be progress again on the hostage front. A top Shiite leader in Lebanon has called on the groups concerned to give what information they have on the missing Israelis to break the stalemate. And one well-connected magazine in the country says another Western hostage could be released in the coming week. For National Public Radio, this is Gerald Butt in Nicosia.
Stock prices closed sharply higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Industrials gained 33 points to close at 3,040. This is NPR. A federal judge in Wichita, Kansas today freed an abortion protest leader who was accused of threatening the owner of a clinic where abortions are performed. Reverend Phil Volman was arrested Wednesday outside a clinic operated by Dr. George Tiller after he preached a sermon saying that Tiller's days were numbered and his family was in danger. A U.S. Marshal said he believed the statement was intimidation in violation of a court order. Judge Patrick Kelly freed Volman after watching a videotape of the sermon. Volman argued that he was saying that the clinic operator was in danger of punishment from God. Cuban inmates continue to hold 10 hostages at a federal prison in Talladega, Alabama. Negotiations are continuing around the clock, but prison officials say there are no signs of a breakthrough. Don Gagne reports.
This is day three of the takeover of the maximum security unit at Talladega's Federal Correctional Institution. There are 121 Cuban detainees housed at the facility. The takeover was prompted by word that 32 of them were to be deported back to Cuba this week. U.S. Bureau of Prison spokesman Dan Dove said this morning that the prison employees being held hostage are believed to be okay.
We've been in constant contact via radio, and all indications to us is that the hostages are calm. They're doing extremely well under the trying circumstances, and there's been no harm or no threats upon their life.
Prison officials refuse to comment on any specific demands the Cuban detainees have made, but the inmates, through telephone calls to attorneys and reporters, have vowed to die rather than face deportation. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Talladega, Alabama.
American factories saw an upsurge in orders for durable goods last month. The Commerce Department reported that orders for costlier, longer-lasting products were up by 10.7% in July, the largest monthly gain in 20 years. The report said the gain was felt in almost every major industry except for lumber and wood products. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John Adams is one of the best-known composers in contemporary opera. Peter Sellers is one of the best-known directors. My guest, Sanford Silvan, doesn't have the same name recognition they do, but he's one of the acclaimed singers who's brought their work to life. Silvan was Zhou Enlai in John Adams' Nixon in China, which was directed by Peter Sellers, and Silvan performed in Sellers' televised productions of Figaro and Così fan tutte. Silvan is singing the title role in a new Adams-Sellers collaboration called The Death of Klinghoffer. This opera about terrorists and hostages will have its American premiere at the Brooklyn Academy of Music in September. Silvan also has a new record. It's his first solo record, and it's called Beloved That Pilgrimage. But first I want to play an earlier recording. John Adams wrote a setting of a Walt Whitman poem for Silvan. That poem, The Wound Dresser, was based on Whitman's experiences as a nurse in the Civil War. This is The Wound Dresser.
Bearing the bandages, water and sponge, straight and swift to my wounded I go. Where they lie on the ground after the battle brought me.
Sanford Silvan, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Now, I read in an interview with you that you said when you think of this song, you think of friends who have died of AIDS. What are some of the different settings that you've performed the song in?
Well, we've done it in concert halls kind of all across the country, huge barns and then smaller places. And I think what I was talking about in that article specifically was being in San Francisco singing, that we had finished a tour, a very long tour at the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra, and one of the last performances was in San Francisco. And, you know, I don't often think about specific settings of where I am. I find that limits me, you know, when I'm performing. So I just go out and perform in as absolute a nature as I can find within myself. But it really struck me that afternoon when I walked out on stage in San Francisco that here I was going to sing words to a community who really knew what I was singing about. Because, you know, in a sense, San Francisco and the gay community and AIDS is where it all began, in a sense. And so it just felt very, that identification, that complete, you know, it's like until you sing German Lieder to a German audience, it's very hard to understand that kind of two-way electricity. We're used to that with pop music, you know, we listen to Frank Sinatra and we get it, and there's a two-way street back and forth, and this, somehow the language and the evocation of all that was going on seemed absolutely as immediate as anything I've ever experienced.
I'm wondering if you've been asked to sing at any funerals.
There's a church that I'm associated with in Boston called Emmanuel Church, and they were one of the first churches to deal with people who had died of AIDS, and at a time when certain churches were not accepting people who had died of AIDS. And so I offered myself as part of my own work to sing, and I sang at some funerals, and it was... Often they would ask me to sing specific things, and sometimes it was very, very difficult. I had to sing Somewhere at someone's funeral, and, you know.
The Bernstein Sondheim?
The Bernstein Somewhere,
from
yeah, exactly. Yeah, which in a way is, for a lot of gay people, very much a personal anthem.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in what it's like to sing at a funeral, because it's not a concert. It's not about performing. It's kind of about registering emotion in a kind of different way, certainly in a different context than at a concert. So what do you feel is different about what's expected of you and what's appropriate from you?
Well, the two times that I've chosen or asked to sing at funerals, it was done for me in a sense of what I could offer. I really remove my own. It's not a grieving process for me. It can't be part of that, because then I could never be able to sing. So I usually do it as an offering, both once for a wonderful director, Tim Mayer, I asked and was happy to sing at his funeral, and my cousin who died in 103. Pan Am 103, and it just seemed appropriate. It was the appropriate response at that moment for me, for my family, and then I take the grieving process within myself on another occasion.
So it's possible to move other people without kind of giving in too much of that emotion yourself.
Right, just focusing. I mean, it's like singing at a wedding in the same. I don't sing at weddings except for people who I dearly love. And when you do that, you know, you can't start kind of letting the emotion of the occasion get to you. But that we come in contact with that all the time, you know. Occasions, times when we're performing. I was thinking the other day that the first time I sang the Britain War Requiem, which is one of the great pieces of all time, I really had to say to myself as I was walking on stage, you know, just focus and don't listen to the rest of the piece, because if I did, I would never be able to get through it, because, you know, in oratorio, you sit there the whole time. You don't go off stage anywhere, and so you just focus and work with what, you know, with what you need to say.
Yeah. I want to show a different side of your singing, and this is an aria that you sing in The Death of Klinghoffer, which you're about to perform in the States, and this is an opera by John Adams, who you've worked with before.
Right.
And it's based on the death of Leon Klinghoffer, who was one of the hostages on the Achille Lauro in 1985, and he was thrown overboard by Palestinian terrorists.
Right, shot and then thrown overboard.
Right.
Right.
You know, a lot of people, when they hear Leon Klinghoffer made into an opera, think, how do you make a subject like that into an opera? Was that ever an obstacle for you, you know, in thinking about playing the role of Klinghoffer?
Well, frankly, we thought that Richard Nixon was even a stranger idea for an opera.
Right, this is Nixon in China.
Nixon in China. So we've kind of gotten over that aspect of, you know, the contemporary issues and whether they seem strange or not.
I want to play an excerpt of one of your arias in which you're expressing your rage at the terrorists.
Right.
Can you talk with me a little bit about singing this and about what you're conveying?
Sure. You know, John, like any great composer, writes music that says more than one thing at a time. And I guess I've always felt that this piece is as much anything as is about his impotence. He cannot jump out of the chair, as it were, and save anybody. He cannot be a hero.
The wheelchair, because he's...
The wheelchair,
right.
He was
in a wheelchair.
He was in a wheelchair. He cannot, for instance, at that moment, physically save or protect his wife. And that is the stuff that I've always used to fuel myself in that aria. You know, impotence, anger, rage, outrage. You know, all the things that any of us would feel were we stuck... that way, I guess, as it were. You know, I've never been, thank God, taken a hostage. I don't know what that feels like. And I think that we're learning slowly from the hostages that are being released that it's a very multifaceted experience. I thought it was incredible. I was reading the other day about how they were teaching each other, you know, their subjects or what their life was about, and I thought that was extraordinary. So for this moment, I think it's very much an incredible mixture of anger, impotence, physical challenge, as it were.
Well, let me play some of this aria
from
The Death of Klinghoffer, performed by my guest Sanford Sylvan.
Mr. Pal, who shot that little girl at the airport in Rome? You would have done the same. I know.
I think it must be really good for a singer like you to be able to perform like elegiac songs and to perform really angry music like this.
Right. It's fun. I think we first discovered, Peter had a phrase for it. He loves my latent street thug, as he calls it. And in this production of Così fan tutte that we did years ago and then has become now well-known through the TV and video version, it was a very interesting thing for me to explore the side of myself that has that much rage and anger within myself, and then to dare myself to not have an audience like me, which is a very big issue, and was a wonderful, wonderful therapy for me to get out on stage in Cozy and really challenge the audience to just want to, you know, want me to leave the stage, you know. And we filled Cozy with all these incredible moments of mean-spirited kind of just obnoxious behavior. And it was a real challenge for me, but I ended up loving it. I think it really liberated me as a performer, you know, so I didn't have to worry about people loving me all the time, which is a dangerous thing for any of us to get involved with.
Why was it so hard? Is it because you're not that used to acting and you're normally performing in a recital context?
No, because recital is as dramatic. It's just that, you know, I think most performers, you know, face this issue of, you know, being true to the work, and if I am thus true to the work, you know, what happens? What will people think of me? You know, separating oneself from the work, and that's a continual process that we all go through. But there were many moments in this production where we actually took it further. For instance, there's a very beautiful trio in the first act of Cozy, which is beautiful. And in our production, it was one of the few moments of actual kind of tenderness and quietness. And literally, the second it was done, there was huge crash of plates, and I'm screaming at the audience. And I could feel people absolutely just rear back and kind of think, I wish you wouldn't do that. You know, and that's a big thing for a performer. We all have to face those issues of wanting people to like us.
Sanford Sylvan is my guest. He has a new album called Beloved That Pilgrimage. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Baritone Sanford Sylvan is my guest. Now, I think most of the operas that you've performed in have been operas by John Adams or directed by Peter Sellars. They've been unconventional operas, either contemporary operas or contemporary updatings of classic operas.
Right.
Why have you avoided more traditional opera?
It's it could be a long answer. I don't know, it's a question whether I've avoided. It's a question of not seeing what I thought opera was about being done around me, and so not finding situations that I could put myself into where I thought that the issues of opera were being addressed. And when I finally saw Peter's work and was asked to be involved, I knew that this is what I had waited for all those years. I knew that we were going to address the issues the way I, you know, think, the issues that I think are important in being addressed, that were addressed by the composer and the librettist. And so it's kind of like that opportunity presented itself finally. It's harder for me to say what I didn't find in these other representations than to say what I did find in what we do.
Which is?
Treating every character as a full and rich human being, never, ever judging our characters from the outside or the inside. In our productions, there are no stock figures. We never make fun of people, per se. We make fun of ourselves. But the characters are as full and rich as you or I would like to be treated, you know, as human beings. I think that's the most important and most basic tenet of Peter's work.
How did you discover classical singing? That might sound like a dumb question, but
no,
you know,
not at
a
all.
Lot of people just grow up with pop and rock and roll.
No, I sang in a chorus always when I was a kid. It's a wonderful story. Lincoln Center Library opened up in 1966, I think. And I was 12, and I thought I was interested in plays, so I went up there because someone said, oh, they probably have a lot of plays there because it's about performing arts. And they had a little film right in the front, a little slideshow about ballet and music and opera and this and that. And I had never seen an opera because in those days there was no opera on TV or anything like that. And I was amazed. And it was 2 minutes of Aida, of Leontine Price singing the triumphal scene from Aida. And I was just kind of blown away, basically. And I stood and watched the same film for about 7 viewings, which took about 2 hours. And then I went upstairs and searched around and asked the person next to me what that was. And he said, it's an opera. It's called Aida. And I went and got the record on my library card. And that was it, really.
Did your parents play any music like that in the house?
No, not at all. We had a piano, so we grew up taking piano lessons. And there was no classical music per se. I don't know why I was drawn to it. When I was a kid, I'd kind of spin the dial, and if there was some opera playing, I might lean in, but it wasn't a part of our household. My parents listened to, you know, Friend in Teicher, of course, and, you know, and Broadway musicals, but beyond that. And I actually didn't listen to very much music before I found myself interested in classical music. I only listened to pop and rock as an adult and became very much, very, very much influenced by certain rocks, you know, pop and rock artists.
Oh, let me stop you there, because I'm interested in hearing you say that. Sure. You know, opera is a form that precedes pop and rock and roll.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
People started singing that way long before Elvis Presley or Frank Sinatra. But
right.
You're singing it after Presley and Sinatra, and after
right.
Everybody who's come after Presley and Sinatra. So
right.
Do you think that that's changed your approach to singing? And I'm asking that because, you know, pop singers have brought a colloquialism into
right.
singing that didn't exist before, and of course microphones help them do that.
Right. I don't think so, frankly. The influence that the popular rock artists brought to me were later. It was kind of later in my mid-20s when I think I had a general idea of what I wanted to do with my singing, and it just was much more. I became, for instance, very much influenced by Bruce Springsteen. But that was as an artist and as a performer, less about vocal technique than just what that man did as a performer and as a musician and as a composer.
How were you interested, influenced by Springsteen as a performer? I doubt you run across the stage with your guitar.
Well, it's more just kind of artistic truth, and that I think he speaks from the deepest possible place when he sings and when he performs. It's every time as if, you know, he could die after that. There's a connection, you know. I used to think, I'll never forget, I saw John Vickers sing a Tristan once, and I thought, it's like he could die from how far he's taking this within himself. And I feel that often when I've seen Springsteen perform. I feel just unbelievably moved by the commitment and the totality of his approach. I also happen to think he sings very beautifully, and everyone, you know, kind of just can't believe it, but I do. I think he sings beautifully. I think he uses his voice just beautifully, even when it's tired, even when he's been shouting a lot. As a singer, it you know, the colors are endless. He makes endless choices of how to use words and line and emotion, absolute emotion.
No, I agree with you.
Do
you ever feel like you know, you're saying that, you know, a singer who gets so deep into himself, he could, like, die from going that deep?
Uh-huh.
Do you ever feel like you're doing that yourself, and can you tell when you are, and does that coincide with when the people you're singing to feel that you've done your best?
Sometimes not. You would be amazed. Sometimes you feel like you've just given everything, and someone will come backstage and say, are you okay?
Yeah.
and you want to punch him.
Yeah.
But you know, there's a real thin line for us. We have to walk a line of a certain kind of technical proficiency, because it is on that line that we transmit the message of the composer and the poet. And if we break past that line and our voice is no longer in command of our mind, what's wanting to be transmitted doesn't get transmitted. So it's, you have to kind of boil the emotion to a certain pitch that is just at that line, and then hopefully let it live there while your mind and emotion meet and pour out what it is you want to say. Whereas I think someone like Springsteen can cross that line with his voice, and yet still the music, the particular music that he does, actually gains from that self-immolating type thing. I mean, I think back when I was, you know, 21 at Tanglewood, a student, and I gave a performance of some Schubert songs where, I mean, at the end of it, I simply couldn't talk. And that was fine for being 21 years old, because the ardor, you know, carries the message, as it were. But that wouldn't be fine, because in the end run, what Mr. Schubert asks me to do is to transmit something with the sound of my voice as well as my emotion and my intellect.
What's the most difficult decision you've had to make about your work as a singer?
I think limiting myself to what I can serve best. You know, in classical music, there are different size voices, different shaped voices. People have different strengths. And to really know, for instance, that I will not sing Wagner, you know, just, you know, that ain't going to happen, because my voice wasn't made to do that. And you reach a point, you know, I'm 37 now, I think just in your early 30s, when you really know what it is that you can do and what it is you can't do. And sometimes facing those things you can't do brings a certain kind of sadness, you know, things you'd love to do. But I'm so lucky, because there's so much to do that I kind of don't, you know, worry about it so much.
I want to get back to when you were hearing Leontine Price for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know you could sing?
I knew I wanted to sing. I didn't know that I could sing. No, it's a good question. I didn't know that I could sing. I just knew I wanted to sing. And it's funny, it's not that I wanted to do that thing which she does, which is, I mean, she was the greatest kind of, she poured the greatest amount of beautiful sound, you know, on us year in and year out. So it wasn't that, it's just I wanted to sing. I wanted to do the thing that's behind her singing, you know, heart and voice, and let it kind of move through me. And since I didn't, even through my college years, I didn't have a conventionally operatic voice, I never thought about what my voice sounded like. I just kept doing what I knew I wanted to do and let my voice follow and hope that it served the needs of the music.
Well, you have a beautiful voice, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your singing.
Thank you.
Baritone Sanford Silvan. His new album, Beloved That Pilgrimage, includes Aaron Copland's settings of some of Emily Dickinson's poems. Here's Silvan singing The Chariot.
Because I would not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me. The carriage held but just ourselves and immortality. We slowly drove in, you know, haste, and I had put away.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we remember the great actress Colleen Dewhurst. She died last night at the age of 65. In a 1987 interview from our archives, she'll talk about one of her most distinctive assets, her husky voice. Composer Todd Machover is best known for his works for electronic synthesizer and computer, but his latest piece was written for cello, the cello of Yo-Yo Ma to be exact. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews the world premiere of Begin Again Again. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Barton Fink, the new movie from the Coen brothers who made Miller's Crossing and Raising Arizona. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. Soviet politicians and organizations are moving themselves away from the falling star of the Communist Party. Political leaders have resigned their party memberships, and reform leaders have seized community party buildings. And as Bridget Kendall of the BBC reports, the move away from the party has reached the most powerful voices of communist power.
The Communist Party newspaper Pravda has asked to abandon its traditional ideological role, and both TASS and Soviet television, the two main vehicles for publicizing the coup leader's decrees, have rushed to suspend party activities in their organizations. But these panicky attempts to dump the Communist Party as quickly as possible came too late for the Russian president, Boris Yeltsin. Today, he suspended the hardline Russian Communist Party, reluctantly endorsed by President Gorbachev, and announced all communist newspapers, including Pravda, would no longer be published on Russian soil. He decreed there should no longer be party cells in Soviet army units in Russia, a move hurriedly copied by the new acting chief of the KGB in what looked like a desperate bid to hang on to the post he'd only been appointed to yesterday.
Bridget Kendall of the BBC in Moscow. Also in Moscow, Soviet leader Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin have named moderates to prominent jobs after purging top officials for their roles during a failed coup. Among the jobs filled are the leaderships of the KGB, Interior Ministry, and Soviet military. These new choices indicate a power sharing between the Kremlin and the Russian Republic in the aftermath of the failed coup in which Boris Yeltsin led the opposition. Former U.S. President Ronald Reagan says that Soviet President Gorbachev should allow the Baltic republics their independence now that he has returned to power. The former U.S. president made his comments in Rochester, Minnesota, after a medical checkup. Joe Follansbee of Minnesota Public Radio has more.
Mr. Reagan said he had a long talk on the telephone with Russian Federation President Boris Yeltsin this morning. Mr. Reagan did not say what they talked about, but he said Yeltsin was very confident and that Yeltsin and Gorbachev were working closely together. Mr. Reagan also had some advice for Gorbachev regarding the Baltic states. He said now was an appropriate time for the Soviet Union to free them, noting they have never been officially part of the Soviet Union. Mr. Reagan said he has not spoken to President Bush during the Soviet crisis. Mr. Reagan said he feels fine following his annual physical at the Mayo Clinic. Mrs. Reagan also had her yearly checkup. Doctors found the former first couple in excellent health. For National Public Radio, I'm Joe Follansbee in Rochester, Minnesota.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 33 points to close at a record high of 3,040.25 on volume of some 187 million shares. This is NPR News. In Yugoslavia, as fighting continues in Croatia, rival groups have issued call-up orders. A Yugoslavian official conceded that a truce ordered in Croatia over 3 weeks ago has collapsed, and he said more than 70 people have died since then. Federal officials met again to talk about a demand from officials in Croatia to pull out Federal Army troops. Officials have charged that the federal government sides with Serbian forces that now control about 20% of Croatian territory. 40 Americans will arrive in Hanoi tomorrow to start a peace march to Ho Chi Minh City, formerly known as Saigon. They hope to help end the 16-year-old economic embargo against Vietnam. Mary Kay Magstead reports from Bangkok.
The U.S. Trading with the Enemy Act haunts any American who travels to Vietnam. It limits the amount of cash one can spend and bans trade and investment. 41-year-old Stephen Stratford is a Vietnam vet, returning tomorrow for the first time since he left, embittered, 20 years ago. He says the U.S. should stop punishing Vietnam for simply having won the war.
If they're willing to forgive us, we should definitely be willing to forgive them. It wasn't our country that they came and fought in and destroyed and left people deformed from Agent Orange. And it's like our government wants to squeeze every last little bit they can out of this thing. And I find that disgusting myself.
The peace marchers will spend 2 weeks on foot, in buses and in trains, on their journey from Hanoi to Saigon. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstad in Bangkok.
Senator John Kerry says that the leaders of Vietnam and Cambodia have promised an open inquiry into the fates of Americans still listed as missing in action from the Vietnam War. Kerry says the two countries will allow U.S. helicopters to take part in an MIA search. They also promised, he said, to allow U.S. citizens to make their own on-the-spot investigations. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. One way to get people to listen to contemporary music is to get a beloved star to perform it. But since big stars usually shy away from contemporary music, it's major news when this actually happens. Last week at Tanglewood, cellist Yo-Yo Ma played the world premiere of electronic music composer Todd Machover's Begin Again Again, which was written for Ma. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz was at the performance and says that the fact that Ma was willing to play the composition is a testament both to Machover's distinction and to Ma's good taste.
That's the haunting opening of Todd Machover's Begin Again, Again. Yo-Yo Ma is playing an electric cello, and his notes are being expanded, altered, and accompanied by four onstage computers. Machover calls this relationship between computer and instrument a hyper-instrument. Machover is also known for the way his electronic music combines traditional classical forms with pounding rock rhythms and improvisational jazz. Before the performance, he gave an informal talk about what he and his team of computer programmers and operators were trying to do. He explained how an electronic wristband attached to Yo-Yo Ma's bowing arm gives the computer information about the way he bows, how fast and with how much pressure, and the way the computer transforms these messages into different kinds of sound. There's even a small radio transmitter on the bow and an antenna on the bridge of the electric cello. I'm not sure, though, if all the technical discussion really serves the music. Afterwards, people were talking mostly about the computers. And what's exciting about Begin Again Again is how beautiful and moving and powerful it is, how it lasts nearly half an hour and there isn't a dull moment, how dramatically it builds, and what a great opportunity it is for a magnificent performer like Yo-Yo Ma. The entire piece is actually a series of 10 variations in two movements. After the quiet opening, it revs up. It gets faster and more violent. One variation is called jaggedly aggressive. The world seems to be on the verge of chaos. If there's any fault with this piece, it may be that the aggression continues too long. But suddenly, there's a kind of suspension. The cello stops, but the music continues like an aftershock. This is the point where Yo-Yo Ma exchanges the electric cello for his Stradivarius. We begin again, again, at the still center. Thank you. But that stillness is threatened. It's as if morning had come and the birds had awakened, and again we begin again. It's very moving that the whole orchestral range of the accompaniment is actually generated by the real cello at the moment it's being played. Nothing is on tape. Nothing is manufactured out of nothing. It's as if all these sounds are inherent in the cello itself and in the way Yo-Yo Ma plays it. I don't know if I share Macover's conviction that this is the music of the future. I'm happy enough that it's the music of the present.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. This is Fresh Air. Last night, we lost a great actress. Colleen Dewhurst died at the age of 65. There are many performances we'll remember her for, her acclaimed interpretations of Eugene O'Neill, her portrayal of Woody Allen's vision of the ultimate Gentile mother in Annie Hall. More recently, she played Murphy Brown's mother on TV. Today, we remember Colleen Dewhurst with a 1987 interview from the Fresh Air Archives. Dewhurst was a tall, broad-boned woman, and she told me that influenced the kind of role she got.
When I was in my 20s, and everything, everywhere I went, they'd speak of how tall I was. In fact, I really got started. I mean, I was always playing the woman who was leading the army in Shakespeare, or ate her children in a pie, or broke up the family, or something. And then I've noticed that maybe in the last 10 years, suddenly there are very tall women out there that 5'8" is not considered terribly tall or terribly big. But for a while there, I would not, when I began to break through, I would not be hired because the leading man was not tall.
We know what I'm thinking, too. You have very strong facial features, and it looks, you look like a strong woman. You look physically strong and emotionally strong, and it would be hard for you to play the kind of frail, vulnerable leading lady, you know, and there have been periods where leading ladies have been that way.
Well, I think probably it was that I was never an ingenue. I could never, in other words, entering New York, I think, when I was 20. And everybody in that age span that was coming in, that was were ingenues. And I remember saying to Joe Papp one time, he hadn't seen me, and it was when he was first starting, and he just called me on the phone and said that his wife had seen me in a class and thought I would... that he was going to do Romeo and Juliet. He had taken a small church down on 6th Avenue and 6th Street. And I went, "You've never seen me, have you?" And I said, I said, "Well, I couldn't do Juliet when I was 12. I knew by that. I knew nothing about my voice or anything. Only when I hit into New York did people begin to pick out characteristics about you in a class, they would mention something, right?
Well, I think your voice is one of the most striking things about your performances. You have such a wonderful voice, and its huskiness has so much a kind of character in it and a certain, oh, even mystery to it. Have you worked to develop your voice at all?
No, I would always, every once in a while, I'll see someone commenting on the voice, and I'll hear something about whiskey. They'll have a whiskey will come in there, whiskey something tone voice, or cigarette. And finally, one time I said to somebody, you know, I said, I have to tell you that when I was in sixth grade, because I can remember it vividly, I said, each class, I said, had to do a country, and our country was Russia. And I was very excited because all our little group was doing were the boys and the girls together were singing a Russian song, which went, "Eugnem, Eugnem." And the day came, and my mom and dad were coming that night and everything, and I had my little Russian dress. And so in came the music teacher. And she said, and the girls sang first, and then she said, she did the girls, and then she went, "There's something wrong on the girls' side." And she said, "Girls, will you go again?" And so all the girls were going, "Eugnem." And in the middle was me going, "Eugnem." And she went, "What is your name?" And I said, "My name's Colleen." And she said, "Colleen, tonight, just mouth it."
So you had a deep voice, even
yes,
then.
Yes, I obviously, but I never was conscious of... my sons used to laugh because when I would call home, collect... And one of them would pick up the phone and they'd say, "We have a collect call for anyone from a Mr. Dewhurst." And there'd be a pause and I'd go, "Yes, I'll accept it. Hi, Mom." There is no Mr. Dewhurst.
You know, I should mention, people said, "Oh, it's a whiskey voice." No, it's a cigarette voice. You do smoke cigarettes.
Yes.
Have you tried to stop or anything because of your career on stage or life in general?
No, I think I've, three or four times I've tried to stop for reasons which probably more involve sons,
uh-huh.
You know, that they get tense, and I can understand that, yes, it would be your fault if you were to go before time, so to speak.
You made a little joke before about taking roles that you're offered. Do you take what you're offered, or do you turn down roles that you don't?
In the theater, I turn down.
Uh-huh.
But quite honestly, in film and television, there was a period there where, well, there were a couple of periods where I took roles that paid very well.
Mm-hmm.
But that I wasn't, I think, I always say the dangerous thing is to take something and then try to make believe. I mean, when you get on that plane for California, you cannot sit there and say, to someone. I've had it said to me, well, of course, you know, this isn't really, the script isn't terribly good, but I feel there is something in the part that I want to go, oh, come on. We're flying out there for the money. They're hoping, they're paying you for fast. They figure you'll study, that you'll go to bed at night, and that you'll be there on time, and that you're not going to make a fuss or worry about your hair or anything, that you'll be on the set. You'll know your lines, and you may try to make it look like more than a cardboard cutout of a woman. But there's been a couple of years now that I've played for TV that I've really, really loved the experience.
Actress Colleen Dewhurst from a 1987 interview. Dewhurst died last night at the age of 65. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, Robert, what kind of post-coup analysis do we have today?
Well, first we have the news of what seems to be a kind of power-sharing arrangement between Mikhail Gorbachev and Boris Yeltsin, and not much question about who has more of the power. And Mr. Yeltsin seems to be naming the key members of the new Soviet government that will nominally report to Mr. Gorbachev. Also, we'll hear about what happened to those nuclear codes that Mikhail Gorbachev had, whether there'll be a purge coming up in the Communist Party. We'll also hear about the king of the B-films, Roger Corman, striving to rewrite one on a Soviet coup to make it current, and Yevgeny Yevtushenko's poem to Yeltsin.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Joel and Ethan Coen have made only four features, but film critic Stephen Schiff says they have already established themselves among the most fascinating contemporary filmmakers and the most mysterious. The Coens say they co-write their films and that Joel, the older one, directs while Ethan produces, but those who work with them say they're like one person in two bodies. Stephen has a review of their new movie, Barton Fink.
What's the sound of an audience at a showing of Barton Fink? Toward the beginning of the film, knowing chuckles. At the one-third mark, out-and-out guffaws. Halfway through, sharp gasps and occasional whoas and wait-a-minutes. At the end, silence, raised eyebrows, frenzies of head-scratching. Barton Fink is weird, no doubt about it. And because it goes from being a deft satire of Hollywood in the late 30s to a kind of Grand Guignol creep show, it might strike a lot of people that the Coen brothers are pulling their chain. Maybe so. But I've always liked the Coens' brand of chain-pulling. Yes, their characters are usually silly or dislikable, and yes, their bravura camera work has a show-offy edge. No one watching a Coen film has to be told it's only a movie. The picture itself is screaming that in your ear all the time. But the Coens are the smartest, most skillful pastiche artists now working in film. Like the good postmodernists they are, they appropriate like mad from every nook and cranny of movie history, and yet, from the shards they gather, they build structures that are unmistakably their own. Barton Fink may remind you at times of The Shining, and even of David Lynch, but what it really is a gonzo new version of Faust. Barton, played by John Turturro, is a leftish Broadway playwright in the Clifford Odets mold. He's lured to Hollywood, as Odets was, and put to work writing a typical wrestling picture, as though there really were such a thing as a typical wrestling picture. Fink checks into the ghastly Earl Hotel and proceeds to suffer an epic case of writer's block, while all around him mosquitoes buzz and bite, and wallpaper peels, releasing a gelatinous goo. Just when Fink's life is getting horror movie creepy, in bounces his next-door neighbor, the mysteriously affable Charlie Meadows, played by the unfailingly wonderful John Goodman. When Charlie hears that Barton's a writer, he's lost in admiration.
Well, what kind of venue, that is to say, thematically,
what do I write about?
Caught me trying to be fancy. Yeah, that's it, Bart.
Oh, that's a good question. Strange as it may seem, Charlie, I guess I write about people like you. The average working stiff, the common man.
Well, ain't that a kick in the head?
Yeah, I guess it is. But in a way, that's exactly the point. There's a few people in New York, hopefully our numbers are growing, who feel we have an opportunity now to forge something real out of everyday experience. Create a theater for the masses based on a few simple truths, not on some shop-worn abstractions about drama that don't hold true today if they ever did. I don't guess this means much to you.
Hell yeah, I could tell you some stories.
And that's the point, that we all have stories.
Unfortunately, Barton is so self-righteous and obtuse that you never begin to care about him. It's the film's biggest flaw. What overcomes that flaw and makes Barton Fink the startling entertainment it is the Coens' nod to Faust. You remember the story of the man who's offered knowledge and success in this life but must sell his soul to the devil to get it? Selling your soul is what high-minded writers have always thought the lure of Hollywood represented. But in the Coens' case, the studio boss isn't Mephisto after all. Goodman's Charlie is. The Coens' dark joke is that it's Barton's search for the common man, like Faust's search for knowledge, that leads him straight to hell. But, oddly enough, Charlie, who's both the devil and the only common man in sight, can't manage to buy Barton's soul, because Barton won't listen to him. Barton's too absorbed with his own idealistic prattling to receive the knowledge that Charlie has to impart. So almost in spite of himself, Barton is saved, booted out of hell, and left to twist slowly in a vaguely pleasant purgatory, in short, Southern California. All of which sounds slightly heavier than it plays, but only slightly. Make no mistake, this is a comedy, but it's a very dark, disturbing comedy. In Barton Fink, the Coens take you to hell and back. And the ride may leave you feeling shaken.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis and Joyce Lieberman. Chris Burgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with actress Mary Beth Hurt. She co-stars with Barbara Hershey and Sam Shepard in the new thriller Defenseless. She made her movie debut in Woody Allen's Interiors. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.